His computer.
There
Did
you
you get
go.
that? Okay.
You've started recording.
I'm gonna pause the recording. Hey, so we have Tim Tangalini here, who has indulged us with a chance to sort of ask him a series of questions, both about his research in general, as well as the paper he gave us as part of the keynote for this workshop. And I thought we would start by asking Tim to tell us a little bit about his own background and how he got started. And I know he's from an academic family, and how did that affect what he thought he would do in his life? And maybe we'll just start there.
Yeah. So thanks, John. And thanks for inviting me to give the keynote. And thanks for giving me the opportunity to have this informal, albeit virtual, discussion with you and I assume all of our audience members. Look forward to hearing from people and your reactions to the keynote. My pathway into academia is kind of long, and I think, like anybody in academia, a little bit unexpected. My dad was and is actually a theoretical physicist, and that actually gave us opportunities to travel all over the world, very poorly because he was a poorly paid academic. But when he took sabbaticals, we went to Italy, and we went to other places. He had started off at the Niels Bohr Institute, and as the joke goes, most physicists of a certain age have Danish wives. And so my mom is a Dane, and I grew up partly in Denmark, mostly in the United States, but I grew up speaking Danish. I think when I was in high school, I decided under no circumstances would I be an academic. I saw how hard it was for my dad. I saw how complicated the politics of academics could be. And I also saw that the compensation was probably not commensurate with the amount of work that went in. So I really did go into college thinking under no circumstances will I go into academia. My initial goal, because I had been working in cartography, I got in a summer job working in a cartography lab. It just is not a normal summer job. That's what I did. I worked in a cartography laboratory at Clark University and was fascinated by the process of taking data and putting it onto maps quite manually. This was well before we had GIS. We had manual GIS. And I thought, I'll major in geography. And as part of the sort of being at the cartography lab at Clark, I was also allowed to take one class for free in the evening. So I took a class in Lisp programming. This is back in the 1970s. I thought, oh, this is kind of interesting. Can I make a computer behave as if it were a human? And so Lisp was one of these very early high-level languages that was really focused on AI and probably things like Turing tests, which as a 17-year-old I knew nothing about, and probably even if you told me about them, I really wouldn't have cared. I got to college and I thought, I'll major in geography, right? This would be fabulous. And so I walked around my college asking people where the geography department was. And finally, somebody who actually knew about this said, well, actually, we closed our geography department in 1945, because the whole field seemed a little bit like plumbing.
what?
Okay, I won't major in geography. And so I thought, okay, well, I'll major in, my other thing that I liked was computer science. I'll major in computer science. So I went over to the science building and I started poking around asking where the computer science department was. I took my freshman year, I took a course in computer science, and I said, oh, I'd love to major in this. I'd like to do computer science. Said, well, actually, we don't have a computer science department. We have applied mathematics. I thought, oh, that sounds really hard. And so I took the first applied mathematics class, and it was unbelievably hard. I mean, it was so hard, I could get nothing to work on my computer. Fast forward to earlier last year, and I was just talking to friends who had been on the college newspaper with me, and we were going through some old tear sheets, and I found one that basically said that the software that we were trying to use was unusable. And therefore, everybody who had been in this class, you know, could count that towards their major. I had never bothered to find that out. I just thought I was the stupidest person in this entire pre-major, and I just dropped it. So then I thought, okay, I'll do what everybody else is doing, which is economics or government. And I was sitting around with some friends, as you do at the end of freshman year, filling out your study cards. And we were joking, quite frankly, we were joking about folklore mythology and who would major in that. And I'd taken a folk and myth class. I loved it. And I sort of bet the other guys that I'd major in folk and myth.
You bet them.
So I won the bet. And the bet was enough money for me to change my study card. And as I was filling out my change of study plan, telephone rings, and person says, hello, this is Albert Lord. I'd like to speak to Mr. Timothy Tangerlini. And I was like, yeah, I'm sure it's Albert Lord. I hung up the phone. about 3 minutes later, the phone rings again. Says, this really is Albert Lord. I was like, oh yeah, let me get my roommate, Tim. Hey, Tim.
Hello.
So then I realized that, you know, this would be great. I'd get to meet all of these wonderful professors, and they were wonderful. And they gave me an opportunity to explore things like photography, to explore things. I continued taking some CS classes, or applied math classes, allowed me to, because I was very interested in this idea of variation and similarity and things. And so very early on, I was thinking, well, I know Danish so well, I could take 200 Danish stories and do some shuffling of them. Mm-hmm. Originally, actually, one of my ideas was to take my CS background and apply it to my Old Norse homework. And so I started working on a morphological analyzer for Old Norse, which it turns out is a really hard problem. In fact, we just kind of finished up an NSF grant we got about 8 years ago. We finished up that project so that now there is a pretty kludgy morphological analyzer for Old Norse. But that was a project I had started in sophomore year in college. When I was finishing up college, advisor asked, you know, what was I planning to do? Well, in the mid 80s, everybody was planning to go to law school. I wasn't any different. He said, well, why don't you take, you know, that can wait. Why don't you, you know, take a few years and explore Scandinavian folklore. And I was like, well, where could I do that? He said, well, you could do that in Berkeley. I was an avid bicyclist. Mm-hmm. I knew that there was good cycling out on the West Coast, also good skiing. And I also knew that all of my classmates who were going into grad school, we're all going to Berkeley. So I thought, I'll go to Berkeley. And so I went to Berkeley, had some wonderful advisors who allowed me to play with computers and do my folklore work. And that's really when I started trying to think about folklore in the context of people, places, and the stories that they tell. And I realized that as I worked with this very large Danish folklore corpus, even when I filtered it for what I called, you know, exceptional storytellers, people who told 20 stories or more, I was still dealing on the order of something like, let's see, I had 110 people who told on average 50 stories. So, you know, somewhere in the 5,000 to 6,000 story range, mm-hmm. even then I couldn't, you know, even though I was young and I should have been able to remember lots and lots of stuff, you cannot remember what's going on with 5,000 or 6,000 stories. So even then I started working on devising methods for finding features in the storytelling of individual storytellers. And since I had so much geographic information, and remember, I knew how to make maps, I could kind of project this onto maps. And so my dissertation was really trying to get at this idea that folklore is by nature kind of a big data-ish field where we could do things that were very consistent and reproducible using maps, using our understanding of history, the people embedded in history, and then the stories that they're telling as a reflection of the cultural ideology that they are always in the process of negotiating with each other. So that's how I wound up in academia. I just got, at the end of graduate school, I was actually applying to law school when I got a temporary position at UCLA. And when I got to UCLA, I thought, oh, this is a really nice place. I think I want to stay. And then I just, you know, got very, very fortunate, had wonderful mentors who helped guide me through the process of going from a temporary appointment to a more permanent appointment through tenure and then all the way up through the ranks.
That Danish corpus you worked with is something you've returned to again and again. And you've certainly, over the span of the couple of decades that your work has focused on a variety of topics, but you seem to always to come back to the work on legends. What's the draw of the legend for you?
Well, so the legend is really, for me, is very interesting because I'm fascinated by how people use storytelling in everyday life. As part of their behavior. It's both signaling behavior, and it's also partly behavior that's trying to figure things out, right? Mm-hmm. So we're constantly telling stories or story parts. And this I actually am inspired by your work, right? Where people, you know, nobody tells, you know, complete stories usually. They tell little bits and pieces, and we have to reassemble them. The great thing about this corpus that other people had mined mostly for ballads and for fairy tales is that I would say 85% of the corpus is legend, because mm-hmm. that's mm-hmm. really what people tell, right? If you ask people to tell me some stories about what's going on around the farm, right, I'm going to tell you stories about what's going on around the farm. I'm not going to say once upon a time there was, you know, a little girl or a little boy who lived in a poor family and tell you a fairy tale. That's very rare, right? Mm-hmm. I'm also, you know, unless you say, hey, why don't you sing me a song that you heard or that you like to sing, then I'll sing you the song. But if I just say, hey, what's going on around here? That's really where people are going to start to tell these stories conversationally. So it was John Lindo who got me onto the legend, right? I had started mm-hmm. graduate school and we were taking a folklore course, and I said, well, you know, he goes, well, what do you want to work on? I said, well, you know, Holbeck is writing this big book on fairy tales. And John Lindo said, yeah, I hate fairy tales. I was like, oh, really? Why do you hate fairy tales? He goes, well, you know, they're pretty much all the same. And I thought, yeah, you know, I think Prop kind of had told us that too. And he said, but, you know, legends are, you know, why don't you look at the legends that these people are telling? And so I spent about a week looking through the published legends collections of this guy, Tom Christensen. I was like, oh my God, this is absolutely fascinating. So it's a window into a life, agricultural life or rural life. And it's not sampled poorly, right? Mm-hmm. With 5,000 storytellers from a country which at the time probably had a population a little bit over a million. So, I mean, this is actually, you know, a very good sample. And they're all very well placed, right? I know where they lived. And then I can correlate that with things. I started getting interested in historical newspaper collections, which now are all digitized. And then I also was really interested because I had biked all over Denmark. I was fascinated by these fields and how they were put together. I'd also spent time working on a Danish dairy farm and a pig farm, another pig. Don't ever work on a pig farm. Dairy farms are great though. The dairy farm I worked on was fabulous. This is probably why I stuck with folklore. So I was working on this dairy farm that was something like pulled right out of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And I started working there in the winter when there was literally no work for me to do, but they made the best coffee and we had fresh cream from the cows.
Wow. Right,
so I was drinking a lot of coffee. I mean, we're talking, you know, 17 cups a day or something like that. I just had tons of energy. And they usually took exchange students because they were going to teach them Danish. Mm-hmm. And on the third day that I was there, I was heartbroken because they were working so hard to teach me Danish. But I'm actually, you know, a native speaker of Danish. So I finally broke it to them that, yeah, I actually speak Danish. I would love to work on the farm. And so they sent me to brushing the cows, which, you know, you might do if you're going to show them, but you don't do on a daily basis. Yeah. But I was brushing the cows on a daily basis. I had so much energy. And finally, one day after a night of beautiful snowfall, I was brushing the cows. And I get all the way to one end of the barn. And I'm looking back towards, we were talking about this earlier, a backlit window. And sitting on the back of a cow was this little guy with a hat. He took his hat off and wiped his brow. And he said, in Danish, he said, wow, that was a lot of work. And I looked at it, it's like, what is that? Right? And I said, is that you, Paul? And Paul, the farmer, walks in behind me, and this little guy jumps out the window. So I check out, I go out to the down to the window. It's new fallen snow. Somebody jumps out the window. There should be footprints. There's right. nothing there. So I tell Paul the whole story, and he goes, oh, yeah, that was the Nyssa, the house elf. Mm-hmm. It's like, you're insane. So I go in and talk to his wife. She says, it's the Nyssa. The sun comes. Now I realize they're all kind of playing a joke on me. I talk to the sun. He's like, oh, yeah, no, it was the Nyssa. 2 months later, I'm studying at a Danish folk school, and I'm talking about, you know, my experiences in Denmark, and there was a young woman who was from Fyn, where I'd been working. She said, oh, you were working in Fyn. What were you doing? I said, I was working on a dairy farm. She goes, oh, where is it? I said, well, it's between Nyborg and Odense. She goes, whoa, yeah, Nyborg and Odense, there are a lot of big farms there. She goes, but there's this one cool old farm. Man, it's like something out of the 19th century. They have a Nyssa. Unprompted. I was like, okay, I've got to find out more about this. And so I've made it my career.
Well, it's, you know,
true story.
If that's where the work that takes us through to COVID conspiracy theories began, then that's a very fortunate thing for the rest of us. I think one of the things that's fascinating about that, the keynote, is you sort of make a case that people build their worlds out of legends. And that the best way to sort of discover those worlds is, or to discover the legends and the structure of those legends, is through networks, which is not necessarily, I think, an intuitive matter. We think about narratives as being sort of sequential, and here you are giving us the sense that we can approach these things through networks. And so, you know, you've been at this, been at folklore studies for a long time, but you've also been interested in networks for a long time. How did that get started?
So my interest in networks, I think it was probably, there for a while, because you can do a lot of things with networks. And certainly there were some social scientists who had been looking at social networks. I think of Gary Allen Fine. He'd done some really excellent work bringing networks into folklore. And then in 2007, I mentioned this morphological analyzer that I had worked on. I was giving a talk about that, and some mathematicians who I think were just, I don't know what they were doing, coming to a talk about Old Norse morphological analyzers, but there they were. And after that talk, they invited me to spend a semester at the Institute for Pure and Applied Math for a program called The Mathematics of Knowledge and Search. And after I realized, you know, after I, well, first I said, you've got the wrong, I don't know what the heck you think, you know, why me? Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, no, we definitely want you there. We want somebody who's in the humanities to learn, you know, to be part of this community. And that's where I started getting interested in machine learning. And also, for reasons not immediately clear, but back in grad school, I had taken a course in linear algebra because I was interested in decision trees in storytelling. So were there game theoretical elements of that which could be applied to the different paths that you can take through a story? But now you see I've created a network through the story, and you can use matrices to sort of represent both the choices, but also the connections between different parts of the story. And so this really kind of, as I worked through this, and I met some wonderful computer scientists, applied mathematicians at IPAM. And the more I sort of talked about my ideas, the more it became clear to some of them that really what I was interested in was basically networks and how we could apply network models to not only aspects of, for example, narrative, like we're doing here with the conspiracy theories, but also to folklore writ large. I mean, you think about it, folklore is informal, cultural expressive forms circulating on and across social networks. Mm-hmm. I mean, that for me was a revelation. I was like, oh yeah, that's what I'm studying. And if we're studying that, then we are now in kind of the golden age of this, because everybody's out there self-archiving their informal cultural expressive forms in the context of these networks. Mm-hmm. So networks then become a very powerful tool to think with. They're not the only tool to think with, right?
Sure.
But they're a very powerful tool to think with. And that led me to propose, actually IPAM really wanted me to do something with humanities. And we kicked around a bunch of ideas. We had looked at image analysis, but I don't really know that much about image. We had thought about time varying data, things like music. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know, I want to do something kind of machine learning-ish. And I think, you know, if we use networks as a model, and everybody jumped on that, they're like, oh yeah, networks, that's it. So I used IPAM as sort of a host for an NEH Office of, what do they call it? Office of Digital Humanities, Institute for Advanced Topics in Digital Humanities. And because we had all of this IPAM infrastructure, we were able to put together a program that now is kind of their model program for these institutes.
Well, there was certainly, you know, as I said to you earlier, a lot of early career and mid-career scholars in the humanities who got their start in doing network studies, and their sort of their entree into machine learning and other algorithmic approaches happened there. It's been 10 years since you organized, or actually since you that institute took place. What do you wish we had done that you sort of didn't get included in that seminar looking back?
Well, just I don't one know. Thing. That was a pretty packed seminar. So yeah. I don't know if you recall, I was practically getting people up at 5 a.m. for a morning run before we would muster for breakfast and then work until late at night. I don't know that we had funding to do anything more than we already did. And then I was incredibly fortunate that that it was so well received both by our humanities colleagues and by computer scientists and applied mathematicians that IPAM asked me to put together a team to do a long program. And these are the long programs. They take a semester and then they have a couple of follow-ups over the next 2 years. So it's really a 3-year program. There are lots of people competing for this because the funding is effectively it's close to $1 million, right? Mm-hmm. And this is where we can bring in 60 people and put them in residence and have hundreds of speakers. And it really was when we got to that long program in culture analytics, which took several years to get approved, and then it took several years to plan. So there's kind of like 4 years there. So really after my 2011 bounce back seminar for networks, I breathed for about a year. Mm-hmm. And then I jumped right back into the process of putting together the culture analytics long program. And I think the culture analytics long program, and I suspect many of our audience members were part of that, was an opportunity to do the kinds of things that we perhaps weren't able to do in that short but very intense Institute for Advanced Topics, which I think, I hope, has had resonance throughout both the digital humanities and sort of computational approaches to humanities and qualitative social sciences.
I think so. I was impressed by the number the amount of and range of work being done at the Digital Humanities Conference last year. And then I'm impressed by the amount of work going on in the current program, which is all happening virtually over the next week. But looking at the program, a lot of people have taken up, I think, some of the challenges and some of the interesting ideas that long program laid out. So before we let you go, let's turn to the keynote itself a little bit and, you know, I think one of the things that is really fascinating there is that you and your group develop this ability to extract these multidimensional networks. And that the move to think of narratives themselves as networks is especially insightful. But in your talk, you kind of tease this notion of looking to replicate the New York Times graph. But clearly, there's quite a bit more going on there as you unfold Bridgegate and Pizzagate and then go into the COVID conspiracies. There's obviously more things you've been thinking about and have begun with some time to digest and to articulate them. Where do you see this work heading next?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So one of the original motivations was, I mean, we really were just sitting, I believe we're up at Arrowhead having a beer and talking about conspiracy theories. And the question was, could we devise an automated method that could be validated against something? And, you know, narrative graphs have been kind of in the mix for a while. It's just that they were really laborious and tedious to generate because you had to do it manually. So the question was,
and also really not very rich. I mean, I think one of the things that your graphs really do is they really bring richness to the
yeah, possibilities. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, the reason they're probably not that rich is because, you know, they're so hard to do. Now, I had already been playing character social networks for dynamic character social networks for Icelandic sagas, mm-hmm. right? So we've already been kind of thinking about, well, how do these things work? And of course, Grabas's notion of actants and interactant relationships gives you something to hold on to. And then of course, the New York Times graph was external validation material. Mm-hmm. In folklore, as you know, there's no canonical version of something. So what's your ground truth? Mm-hmm. Right. So we were like, okay, well, let's just use that as ground truth and let's see how far we get. And then as we started working this way, we realized that we were getting not only really far, but we were also discovering structural features that set a conspiracy apart from a conspiracy theory. And then we could start to see that these, when people activate little parts of the graph, they're probably telling either legends with a resolution to the story, or quite often sort of circulating rumors, which, you know, seems often say, well, this is what's happening. What are you going to do about it? Right. So mm-hmm. it pushes the complicating action of threat back into the real world and asks you to come up with a strategy for dealing with that. Mm-hmm. And the more we played with this, the more we realized that this was probably what was going on. Mm-hmm. And then as we applied the methods, we got validation of our methods. And then these other things started to pop out. So with Pizzagate, it's kind of a fully formed conspiracy theory, and it really relies on WikiLeaks, and we show that. If you take out WikiLeaks, the whole thing falls apart. Well, COVID-19's got no smoking gun, right? There's nothing. It's not like, oh, I found this cache of emails, mm-hmm. and I'm going to interpret them in this way, and it's going to show you that X is happening. There's nothing like that. So that means it's kind of a conspiracy theory free-for-all, because, mm-hmm. as you know, as humans, we're trying to figure out what the hell's going on around us, right? And I can read everything I want. I can quote do my research, but I'm much more likely to also bounce these ideas off of friends and people who I trust. And then when I start forming an idea, I'm going to tell you stories that are going to try and get you to come around to my way of thinking. And I think that's really what happens in the Wild West of things like Reddit and the real Wild West of things like with all of the negative associations that brings with it, of 4chan and even worse 8chan. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we realized was that in Pizzagate, we kind of already knew where the threats were, mm-hmm. right? So in this model, right, we come up with complicating action, colon, threat or disruption, right? So what is it that the group finds threatening? What do they find disruptive? And then the next step is, what are strategies for dealing with that, right? So that's a very nice internalized narrative structure we had. We realized that because it is so, you know, open, we needed a threat classifier. And so developing the threat classifier using some NLP at least would give us candidate threats. And when we put those into the graph, we're like, oh, in fact, we've got other parts where we filter the graph. We only show you the threats. Right. And if you only look at the threats in some of these overlapping communities, you're like, oh, I know what that's about. Right. So that's been really huge. The next thing is to characterize strategies. Right. And so those kind of come after threats. Right. So and then we're starting to get towards sequencing. Right. The other thing we want to be able to do is the computation for this is a little bit dicey. Right. It can take. So like when we're scraping Reddit and 4chan, it takes us almost the entire day to do the scrape. And then we got to start all over again, right? Mm-hmm. The next day, right? So we're pushing up against that boundary. And then we've got all of the stuff that we need to filter and then compute on. What we'd like to do is to be able to get to a position where we can kind of start to see things forming in real time or with less of a lag. So you can start to see, oh, this thing is starting to become in these conversations considered a threat. And that can give us, that can help be helpful, because while I love to just sort of sit back and observe it, mm-hmm. people are actually taking real world actions on these things that are both dangerous and destructive.
Yes. Right?
People are attacking people. People are, you know, burning things. People are, hell, people are just getting together at a pool without masks on and spreading the virus, you know, quasi inadvertently, but deliberately avoiding not following very simple public health directives.
Yeah.
And then there's this whole thing that's, it's a hoax, right? Mm-hmm. This is a huge part of what we discovered, that a large part of these discussions are, it's a hoax, masks are dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And neither of those are true.
Well, one of the things that I like about what you've just said, and that you introduce a little bit of it in the keynote, is the sort of iterative nature of this process of, you know, this doesn't all sort of get handed over to the computer and it turns out a pretty graph for you. You go, ah, yes. I mean, it's clearly you go and you look through the data, you comb through it, you get bad results, you have failures, and then you see something, you think, okay, let's try and highlight that. I think it's really useful. And I think especially in the context of this workshop, that people need to know that there's lots of trial and error.
Oh yeah, there's no, you know, magic sauce, and you're not going to be, I'm not going to trust a system where you push a button and out comes a result or an answer. I mean, there's a lot of work, but our goal is to refine these methods so that they become useful to people who aren't so down and in the weeds with these methods, right? So we've spent a lot of time learning about these methods and refining them. We can say, well, you know, this is how, you know, we can do it and do it in a way that's both efficient and we can validate the results, you know, against something else. So in our most recent paper about COVID-19, the COVID-19 conspiracy theories, we're now validating it against the reporting on the conspiracy theories. And we're seeing a very interesting and very short time frame between there. You'd think that they might oscillate like this. They're right. Oscillating like almost on a daily basis. They're so tightly connected. Whereas at the beginning of the pandemic, conspiracy theories in the news were basically QAnon.
Mm-hmm.
And then the things that were going on here were developing fairly rapidly. And as we get more and more into this situation where we realize we don't know much about this disease and it's actually a really big deal, the news and the conspiracy theories have moved much, much closer together in this the signal space.
And there's, and to that point, there's just that signal space is so large.
Yeah.
The number of places where people are signaling to each other is unfathomably large.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the other thing. I would love to be able to increase the scope of this. The outcome of some of our papers, people have volunteered to give us very large computational resources and some better layout algorithms. And mm-hmm. we're, you know, as you know, this group is really small. There are five of us and we were not funded. So it's hard, but it's really fun. And, you know, for me, as a computational folklorist, it really is, you know, this point where you're like, it's an inflection point. It's like, yeah, we've been telling you, because people, and I'm sure you've experienced it as well. It's like, oh, you study folklore. How quaint.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, it's more than just quaint. It's actually something that is deeply affecting the way communities operate.
Well, I like the way you frame all of this as a kind of ongoing dialogue or conversation. Partially, I know it's a product of the fact that you do have a small group that you're working with, and you've been working with that group for a while. I've had a chance to sort of watch you across a room walking with Vami. So that, you know, I think it's important for people to know that one of the joys of this work is the chance to work with others and to have these conversations and to be able to voice some of your analytical concerns to somebody else who could say, well, you forgot about that. And I really appreciate the way you've kept that notion of dialogue and conversation open.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely crucial as we move forward in culture analytics and digital humanities as a whole. We can't be monastic about it. There really is no high priesthood. Oh, I know how to do this and you don't. The only way you get good work done is parts of teams. And I know in the humanities, we don't have the longest tradition of working in teams, and even promotion and things like that are often based on the singly authored monograph. But to do this work and to do it well, I just don't see how you do it well without being part of a broader group of experts who are bringing together and focusing on very complex cultural issues. Culture's complex. I mean, a lot of people haven't really approached it computationally because it's like, oh yeah, if you know something about computation, like it's like, yeah, I don't know, how would we formalize something like culture? And now we're starting to, we're picking away at it. And I think there's a huge mountain ahead of us. But I think that's exciting, right? It's sort of like we're at the bottom of this. And the more teams we put together and the more, diligent engagement with each other we have, the better off we're all going to be.
I couldn't agree more. And I want to thank you for being part of this conversation, for being one of the people who started the conversation. And with any luck, we'll keep the conversation going. So
I certainly hope so. And please, anybody wants to reach out to me, Tango, that's my email address, Tango. And now it's tango@berkeley.edu. So it's pretty easy to find me.
We'll be sure to include that when we're talking with people during the workshop live. So thank you very much. Great. Sir.
Thanks so much, John.
All right. Bye.
Bye.